This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 12th of November, 1951. The title of this lecture is Basic Postulates. This lecture is 57 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
At first, certain phenomena in the mind were discovered which could be treated, and which produced a rather marked change in people's psychosomatic illnesses. This system was a system of running engrams, moments of pain and unconsciousness, out of a person's life, and running out secondaries, which is to say, moments of grief and stress. Actually, you can still do this. You could take somebody whose commentary upon the transiency of human emotion. It's always been a step fixed thing up to this last year that a human being became sad, he became sad. Well, fellow's best friend or closest relative could die. There an auditor around, there would certainly be no repercussion. You have seen people die and the people around them become ill, sad, life all gone to pieces. Ever since poor old Bill insisted on getting in that automobile wreck, my life has been ruined. You know, that sort of thing. Very serious proposition. But in Dianetics, you could run what is called a secondary, that is, the moment of receipt of news of loss, run that straight on through, perception by perception, to the end, and discharge the grief in such a way that the human being, bright, sunny, cheerful. I saw a woman who looked about 50, I guess. I was told that she was only 28. Gee, she looked a lot older than 28. And her husband had died about 2 weeks before. There were two other auditors and myself in the area. I said, why don't you do something for her? Going around black, hollow-eyed. Anybody say anything to her, she just cringed, start to weep again. Bad shape, endocrine system going to pieces. Why don't you do something? Her husband was a medical doctor who had been had great hopes for Dianetics. So finally, one of the auditors was with me, took her, threw her down on a couch. Let's go back to the moment when you learn of your husband's death and so forth. Took about 9 hours to discharge this secondary engram and three or four other such deaths in her life. And I saw her about 4 hours after the session had been concluded. She was wearing a red dress. She looked like she's about 23, bright, cheerful, sparkling. Life was wonderful. Somebody remarked to her, said, why? Your poor husband, you know, died, so on. She said, yes, but I'll just have to make the best out of it. All right, so there was efficacity in doing this. Well, it hasn't changed, not a bit, that an engram can so affect or influence a person. As a matter of fact, you can take a subject like Black Dianetics, very simple subject. If you have any enemies, just give me a close attention here for a moment. I'll show you what to do with them. You hit them over the head, shoot them in the arm with some sodium pentothal, something like that, rat poison, Calvert whiskey, anything poisonous. And Seagram's is okay, but Calvert's pretty bad. Stamp on them so it doesn't leave a bruise or anything like that, and then read them off an engram with all of the Dianetic phrases in it, like This is a grouper. You're in a grouper. You're in my valence. You can't get up. You're there. You are stuck. You're going down. All of your memories in present time. This is now in present time. You are very sick. You want to be sick. You have agreed to be sick. Yak, 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 and on. And all I can do is run up and down the street screaming, kill me, kill me, kill me. Well, the fellow will. And he'll wake up. He won't be aware of what has happened to him, and neither will anybody else. It's not against the law, by the way. The only person that can complain is him, and you've told him to forget it. That's correct. It's not against the law. Anytime he went up to the DA's office and said, do you know that so-and-so knocked me down with Calvert whiskey and read me an engram and kicked me in the stomach while he was doing it and so forth, they'd say, yes, yes. They send for a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists come up and say, these are the symptoms of paranoia. Take out his pinched nose, look, and so on. Yes, that's the way all paranoiacs act, and that's what they claim, that somebody's drugged them. And he'd say, all right, you have to send him to the insane asylum. He'd send him to the insane asylum, give him an electric shock, give him prefrontal lobotomies. An engram is an engram. That's all I'm trying to drive home here. It is. But there was more to the picture, and little by little that more has been showing up. Nature has been revealing her little treasures and secrets at a very slow rate of speed. It's taken over a year and a half to solve all the riddles of the human mind. Well, that's a long time in Dianetics, a year and a half. Here's a whole world to be won out there, and here we are still fooling around with trying to convince an auditor that the best thing he should do is not hit the preacher over the head. It's a fact. But just now are we up to a codified procedure of such simplicity and efficacy that you can call it the 25-hour process. About 4 months ago, I busily postulated and ordered to sell the United States government a nice package whereby all of its pilots, would-be dictators, bureaucratic heads, and stenographers could be snapped to. You'd have to have about a 25-hour process. It couldn't be longer than 25 hours to bring them up the line pretty well. Well, let's make it in relatively unskilled hands, let's boost it up to 50 or 75, but a person would just be wasting that much time in it. It did not come about that one arrived at this 25 or 50-hour process by simply canceling out the identity of the engram. There was more to its anatomy than had hitherto been seen, and that more became self-determinism. And that more became effort. It's discovered, and can be very easily demonstrated, that an individual chooses his own service facsimiles. He makes himself sick. Well, how does he make himself sick? He goes back and he gets a complete picture, memory, of being sick. And he holds it up in present time. And he says, see, don't hit me, I got glasses on. Look at me, I'm going along bravely. Martyred, of course. Somehow or other, I'm getting along. Somehow, in spite of this wooden leg, which I seem to have, although my leg is not wooden, but I keep telling the doctor. He keeps shooting me full of acetazole. And nothing seems to happen. Now, I want this cured. You tell the guy, well, you wished it on yourself. Why don't you wish it off yourself? If you said that, it'd be implied, be blunt. He wouldn't like it. But it's true. Of course, he had a very good reason for wishing it on himself. He all of a sudden failed. And he had to have a failure explained. How did he explain this failure? Well, he said, well, my head ached. Well, I had such a headache this morning, I just couldn't go to work. Funny dog on fire that is. About the fifth time he pulls that gag, he's got a headache. 2 years from then, He's going into the doctor's office and said, I don't know what happened to me, but I've got a migraine headache and it just comes on and I can't do a thing about it. So the doctor gives him some HGACH and salt. He shoots him with this. He gives him that, sends him bills. Very remunerative. Well, anyway, a person actually wishes these things on himself. Little kid doesn't want to go to school one morning. Doesn't get up. Mother comes in, and mother has argued at him before and argued at him. He found out that there's nothing works. The more he protests about getting up, the more ambitious his mother becomes about getting him on the deck, cap, shoes, pants, jacket, out. And he gets this routine every morning. And he gets pretty desperate after a while, so one morning he says, I think I'll tell her I'm sick. Of course, none of you have ever pulled that. So he says, I'll tell her I'm sick. So I got a bellyache this morning. I just... 30 years later, this person who is now the assistant executive to the assistant executive secretary of some large corporation is carrying upon his head all the weight and nervous tension of making General Motors or Wheaties or something. He's got ulcers. Where'd he get them? Well, it has something to do with the mind. It's probably a libido theory that goes back into the more or less cross-eyed ramifications of the second Rudy rod. Of course, you wouldn't understand this. But it's all very complicated. If we just cut out your prefrontal lobes, you'll be all set. Operation costs $2,900. Other fees involved, and they get all through, and he still has ulcers. It was too simple, you see. I mean, it's too simple. The fellow suddenly says, I've got a stomachache. Then the next time he's found this gag works. Mama at that time said to him, oh, well, Rollo, you'll have to get up, poor boy. I'll get you something that will soothe your stomach. Nice sympathy. So he feels very smug about it. So about 2 weeks later, he says, very bad. You see, a person puts his life together by saying what his life's going to be. A person says, I'm going to be a great actor. That's the way ambitions come in. A person sees factors in life that he'd like to approximate, and he postulates what he's going to be. Works the same way in illness. By the second or third time that he's pulled this, it's getting awfully automatic. He says, stomachache, and by golly, he has one. And give him another 2 or 3 years of talking about this stomachache, and the first thing you know, he has forgotten. Because he didn't know the mechanism involved, he's forgotten that he ever pretended to have a stomachache. It's real. Now a horrible thing happens to him. It's just terrible. He one morning he wakes up. By this time he's in college or something. And the sudden final examinations are coming on, and he can't quite understand. He knows he's going to flunk monotony, and. That day he's to take that examination, and here he has he's bad stomach. He's just can't go down there and take that examination, that's all. And his roommate says to him, get out of there. You know that isn't a bad stomach. It's just because you don't want to take that examination in monotony. Oh, yes, I do have a bad stomach. Oh, no, you don't. Goes down to the dean's office. What's the matter? Are you faking being sick so you can get out of this examination? Oh, no, nothing like that. I really do have a bad stomach. And by golly, by this time, he really does have one. He has really fixed himself up royally now, because in order to make these other people wrong and in order to make himself right, he's got to have that bad stomach for keeps. Now, these service facsimiles are merely used like you deal cards. They're about that much importance. You use your experiences. As a matter of fact, a man's personality is actually the compound of all the things he has been. But much more exactly, all the things he has decided to be. There, we're just a little closer in on it. Now, when he's very young, he probably has a very high sense of justice. He's playing a little girl named Agnes. Agnes gets up on the second shelf. She pulls down the cookie jar, and it breaks and throws cookies all over the floor. His mother comes in. He says, triumphantly, Agnes did it this time. His mother says, "No, she didn't, you little beast. You're not going to lie to me anymore." Whap, 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 whap. Boy, now we really got somebody that's squared up. This is justice. A human being has an enormous concept of justice. If he had broken the cookie jar, if he had lied about it, then all he would have had to have said was, "Well, all right, I didn't get away with it." But he didn't break the cookie jar, and he's been punished. This punishment doesn't have any cause. His mother's wrong. Now, how is he going to demonstrate that his mother's wrong? Well, he thinks about a time when his mother was sympathetic. Actually, you know, being sympathetic is being wrong. Wonderful stuff, sympathy. You can kill a man with sympathy quicker than anything else in the world, including an atom bomb. Because you have to make the atom bomb first, and everybody is sympathetic. So the little boy says, "I don't feel well." He's gotten over his crying and everything else, but this afternoon he says, "I don't feel well." "Well, that's too bad, Timothy. That's too bad. That's good news." So he says, "When was she really?" "I'll get her yet." And, "Gee, I was awful sick one time with the time that bee bit me. Gave me a headache." "I have a headache, Mom." "She's got to be wrong." And he will jockey around until he's finally got her wrong. But after he's had her wrong for a while, all of a sudden he's tired of the game himself, maybe. Let's say he wants to get up and go out and play. "Oh, no, you're sick. You stay right there." Well, he's failed, actually, when this happens to him. Maybe he goes on a little bit longer and he tries to get sympathy from somebody else. Maybe he's married a girl that reminds him of mother, and the way he handled mother was to have these terrible back pains. He handled mother beautifully that way, but his girl he marries doesn't seem to have any sympathy for these back pains. That means it's failed. And at the moment it fails, the facsimile he was using, the memory he was using of his own back pains, because you see, they were real, actual back pains at some time or another. He's using real experiences. He's just displacing them in time so as to suit his purposes. The second that mechanism fails, he's hung with those back pains because he's got to convince her now that she is wrong. Now he convinces her she's wrong. He can convince her she's wrong to the degree of getting lumbago, spungbago. He can even go so far as to go to a doctor. Now, he'll eventually work it around till he comes up with x-rays, with a medical diagnosis, with something highly authoritative that says, in so many words, "This is a sick man." Those words translate, "He is right." Now, at this time, why, the person he's trying to convince is supposed at that moment to break down and be wrong. "You see all the horrible things you've done to me? All the horrible things you've done to me, and here I have been sick." Now, I'm not just explaining the anatomy of hypochondria. The whole human race comes under this category, and sometimes an individual does these things without realizing he's doing them, and they manifest themselves in terms of glasses. Summer colds, winter colds, fall colds, spring colds. They manifest themselves in glandular interruption. For instance, you find a little kid's born into the world awfully brave, and then he finds somebody gets sympathetic because he's afraid. He's all set then. He's got a surface facsimile. He may discover this by accident. Or he may postulate fear on himself just like this. Somebody's telling him a ghost story. He wants to be obliging, so he says, "Woo, I'm scared." He's all set now. Now something can approximate this ghost story, and he's already set up the chain reaction. Pretty soon it'll get so automatic that he can't even examine his own thinking processes with regard to it. All of a sudden, boom, he's scared. Something happens, fear reaction turns on. Irrational. It's merely irrational because he doesn't know that he is postulating it. Actually, he postulates it so rapidly that he can't even keep track of his own thought line. Now you can take pretty clear back down the track, take him into one of these instances and run him through slow, and you can actually find the moment when he said, "All right, I'll be sick." You say, "Why?" Why do you want to be sick at that moment? And he'll all of a sudden think and say, well, I got fired 3 days before. Here's his failure explained. He's there. In other words, this mechanism of self-determinism was discovered to be, we knew it was there, but didn't know the magnitude this thing could assume. All right, we know the magnitude now. It can assume the magnitude of killing yourself. You'll be sorry when I'm dead. How many little kids do you know, of course you would never have done this, who have walked down the street or crossed the lawn and behind the shrubbery say, they'll be sorry when I'm dead. They'll look into that coffin and they'll look on my stone-cold face. And they'll be sorry they were so mean to me and said such horrible things to me. Of course, nobody here has ever done that. I can see some minds going back to wonder if you did. Well, I assure you, most of you did. One way or the other. That's death you're asking for there. Now, pretty soon a little kid can do these things and more or less handle them very easily. A child's mind is very, very free, is very plastic. He can handle it beautifully. He's in pretty good shape. He acts awfully crazy, but he's actually pretty sane. He knows what he's doing. People then start telling him how serious life is. I don't know when life got this serious. Personally, I've never found it this serious. I have a few times in the past, but I got all those reduced or erased now, so hell with it. Anyway, they start this campaign of, it's serious, Johnny, you must get A. It's serious, Johnny, you must wear overshoes. You'll catch a cold unless you do. It's serious, you must take care of your health. You must worry. You must be a good boy. You must mind. You mustn't get run over by trucks. I mean, they tell them the most obvious things. They convince them life's serious. So the kid gets run over by a truck. So he gets run over by a truck. It's his life. I mean, actually, if he had a viewpoint of this character, he would probably go on and wind up to be a pretty hard morsel to handle along about the time he was 25, 26. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if you had fellows who weren't convinced everything was so serious and who knew they postulated all these things and were pretty well swamped up, and all of a sudden the president sends out greetings. He says, scribbles across the bottom of it, I'm too busy, and mails it back. Be interesting, wouldn't it? What would they do to him? Well, I can tell you they wouldn't do very much to him, because if one guy was doing that, supposing you had 10 million who did that. Selective service sets all up, life is serious, getting these capsules out of the bucket so that they can make the world safe from plutocracy or something. And they start mailing these things out, and they mail them right back. They turn around to their armed services and they say, all right, the Fort Myer Cavalry will now charge on the Selective Service Station at 9th and 8th Streets. Round up all these recalcitrants and bring them in. The cavalry says, we don't believe in it. You know, it'd be a horrible situation. It would mean that somebody in government at that moment would have to get reasonable. Their brains would probably go... Well, you see, it's so easy to handle with fear. All you do is post a set of regulations and you say, we'll do so and so and be at such and such a place, or be shot for pusillanimous conduct in the face of the enemy. We'll go to such and such a place. We'll pay taxes here, so much of your income. Now you've got to be on the job every morning at 9 o'clock. It doesn't matter what you do, but you've got to be there. And you leave the job every afternoon at 5 o'clock, and we all go like automatons. That's great. All you've got to do to make a flock of automatons is simply to cover up this datum about self-determinism. You just mask it. You just say, the environment handles you, bud. Not you, the environment. Psychology. By the way, I remembered that word finally. Psychology says man has to adapt himself to his environment in order to survive. That's the way not to survive. You go around adapting yourself to your environment and you're dead. Because you just get all nicely adapted to environment A26, and what happens? Somebody changes the environment on you. That's grim, isn't it? What happens to the dinosaur? He builds himself a mountain of flesh, and then somebody changes the climate on him. And he had got food left. Big joke, no more dinosaurs. You just get beautifully acclimated, and you get completely adjusted to driving only a T-Model Ford. Where would you be even by 1930 when they had Model A's? In other words, the military is the only one, the only organization in the world, which can survive without changing with the environment. Yes, it has worked out a way of doing this by just being so stupid nobody can do anything about it. For instance, in 1895, the Navy was building a full-rigged ship of the line. Somebody up in the Senate Investigations Committee came down and said, "What you doing that for?" And they said, "Well, they've always been good. They've always been good." And they said, "Well, there's been armor plate now for the last 40 years. Don't you think it's about time you knocked off building this ship of the line?" And they say, "Well, all right." So they knocked it off. Right now, I went up to the Senate and I asked a couple of senators up there. I said, "Did you ever hear of propaganda? You know, brightly like this." And they say, "Yeah, it's bad." "No, no, you use it. You use it on the enemy. You fight ideas with ideas. They're sending an idea at you. It's caving in your labor forces and everything else. You give them an idea. And they don't stop the idea." "Well, what are you talking about?" I said, "Well, that's about the only way you'll be able to fight communism, is give an idea." And he said, "Well, don't you know what we're supposed to do? We're authorized to take a boy, we train him, and authorized to give money to somebody to make a gun. We put the gun in his hands, and we send him over to shoot communists." He said, "That's the way it's done." In other words, governments have a hard time changing, too. One government gets just a pace above the other one in terms of warfare, weapons, or anything else, and we've got somebody dying. And not slowly. In other words, the individual has to be able to change to fit his environment. What happens to you when you lay down a postulate? You say, "I am going to..." Supposing you say, "I like T-Model Fords. I am never going to drive another car." And you wonder for years why you're having so much trouble with that Buick. You see, you've made a promise to yourself. And if you aren't faithful to yourself, why, then you're not faithful to anything, and you wouldn't be handling yourself at all, so you have to be faithful to yourself. So the second you lay down one of these postulates, one of these conclusions, you self-determine, in other words, that you will do or be something. Now, a very little time goes by, and you're in the time stream, which is subject to that postulate you have made, and you are now subject to it. So in order to change, you have to change that postulate. Well, we know what facsimiles are, we know what memory is, we can handle memory, erase it, turn it upside down, wrong side out, do almost anything to it now. So it's all right. You can very swiftly change these postulates. A person who has a lot of set postulates on the line cannot change. He's hung himself. And he just gets worse and worse and worse and worse, and finally they bury him and say, "Poor old George." Very simple. Simple mechanism. Fellow says, "I hate to be young. I don't like being young. I want to be old." He'll get old. He said at the same time, "Old people are dreadful. I don't like old people." So when he gets to be old, which he wanted to be, he then, you see, can't like himself because he's now old. Squirrel cage stuff. About the only safe way you could handle it, you see, is just to pick up the postulates you make. Make all the postulates you want to, and then remember that you made them. It's simple. Very simple. It actually postulates a new way to do your thinking. You can be as serious as you want to. You can keep your word if you want to. Some people do. That's another factor in the society, by the way, that's quite fascinating, is the insistence of the society that a person who is honorable keeps his word. In other words, what a beautiful black Dianetic gimmick. If you can just force a person to always be consistent and always keep his word, then you make him immediately subject to all of his postulates. And the second you've succeeded in doing that, you practically killed him. Wonderful gang. Of course, we couldn't have business without people keeping their word. Because business is honest and ethical, or otherwise. That's why everybody gets it down in writing. Well, when you've got it down in writing, you see what that does. You sign a contract, notary public comes in, he stamps it, seals it, there's signatures all over it, there's whereases, wherefores to make it legal. No document's legal, you know, without three whereases and two wherefores in it. And as a result, what do you get there? You have a contract or a postulate. Now, the contracts you make with yourself are a lot more binding than a business contract, because you just can't go up to the court of law and beat the rap. Now, you've said to yourself when you were three, I'll get even with her. I'll break out in a rash like I did last week. I'll lay down on the floor. I'll scream. I'll fix her. You know very well you're doing it when you're three, but the time you're seven, you're not quite sure what's doing it. And by the time you're 27, why, you're... There you are. Horrible. When you were three, you signed a contract. And that contract's still in existence. There it is, still in existence. The only way to get out, out of this contract is to die. If that contract fails you, you make it, and it fails you, then life had it all worked out. They had a beautiful bear trap fixed up for you. You got up to a point where this contract was no longer workable, and you were suffering from it too much. Life had a solution for you. You died. And then you had a clean slate. You could make a lot of new contracts. Unless you found some use for some of the last contracts that you were using on the genetic line. And so you get this... You get this out-of-valence situation. An individual who ceases to be himself, who becomes mother or father, who so on. You look for the point where they swapped, and it follows the point where, let's say that they were trying to tell father off the way mother did, which is to say they've taken mother's valence as a set of facsimiles, and they're telling father off, and then father somehow or other sees to it that they fail. Nobody's going to talk that way to him, except his wife, of course. And so they break the kid down. Well, the kid will go out of valence at that moment, because he chose a valence. He knew he chose it, but now it's failed, and he steps out of valence and into something which he doesn't think he has chosen. Oh, yes, he has. He just sort of died. He gave a token death, you might say, at that point. There's hardly a human being alive that doesn't have a half a dozen of these token deaths back on the track. They're in major prominence. As a matter of fact, there isn't a person here tonight who can't remember an incident which occurred to them which changed their lives. One incident which changed their lives. Major incident of some sort or other. That just earlier than that incident, you seem to be going along one way, and just after that incident, you were definitely going along another way. Well, there's a disconnect in that incident. There's a valence shift. And just that changed your life. Well, you start out more or less with a new life. Right after an operation, for instance, it's very difficult to get people to remember things. If you were to stand around and nobody'd made this test, you give a person an IQ test before, an IQ test after they've had an operation which jars them up, you'll find out a lot of their data has gone by the boards. They're thinking from a new point. They're thinking actually as a new identity to some degree. Because you said a little operation was a token of death. They failed, didn't they? They had to be operated on, didn't they? You can watch this on time track. If you take some of these people who are very seriously out of valence, and we start down the track with them, we can find places where they apparently should be or seem to be in valence. They're not all the way out of valence and so on. And we just go back and forth over a certain point on the track, and we'll find out where they went out of valence. And you can put them back in valence. Not by just telling them to, but by other techniques. All right. It was nonetheless valid then that an engram could do what it could do, or a secondary could do what it could do. But the only reason a late engram or a late secondary, one of these grief charges, a moment of mental pain, the only reason it could do what it do is because you chose much earlier to be affected by such things. You chose in this lifetime much earlier to be affected by them. A child has a great big goal, the goal of growing up. And this goal is big enough and their concentration is on physical development rather than mental development, activity. And as a consequence, a little kid actually finds it pretty easy, pretty early, to handle his mind. What he's having a hard time doing is handling his motor controls. If you were just as you are now, or taken down to the local aircraft field and put in a four-motored bomber, and said, okay, take it off. You look at the throttles, meters. What do I pull, push, short? Undoubtedly, the whole thing works, but how do I work it? And a child is to a large degree in this sort of a situation. He's confronted with a very complex switchboard. How do we make it work? You ever see a little kid? Little kid will be goo-gooing and so forth for the first week or so, and then all of a sudden, he'll discover his finger. He goes through a whole process, which is just as difficult, muscle to muscle, as for you learning how to wiggle your ears. You got to find the right muscle. You got to find the right nerve connect, and so forth. And finally, you get it so the toes wiggle, the ears wiggle, the eyes will cross, and look outward. And actually, nobody has completed that process. That process can be carried on much further than a child carries it on. There's the process by which you can make this hand go in a different direction and speed than this hand. Now, somebody who plays a piano learns how to do that. They struggle at it for a while, but they finally find the right motor controls, and there they are. They're just hanging together physical motor controls, because the body, after all, is just a carbon oxygen engine with a switchboard. Now, another one would be a little more difficult, but you could sit down and practice it if you wanted to, and you'd find out you could do it. You can slow down or speed up your heart action voluntarily. But it's like learning how to wiggle your ears. I mean, you got to find the right muscles. Bunch of Hindus came over to the University of Chicago or University of Illinois or someplace up there. And medicine, I was fascinated when I read about this, but they had a bunch of doctors around and they all looked at these people with great astonishment, since these people could slash a vein and start and stop it bleeding at will. A lot of hypnotists came around and thought, well, if you hypnotize yourself, you can do that, of course. Actually, a hypnotist knows that he can take a subject and put him in a trance and slow down his heartbeat or interrupt his blood flow. You can actually, with hypnosis, knock all the blood out of a hand or an arm so that it's ice cold and practically in rigor mortis. The hypnotist working on this. Well, these Hindus had slashed and could bleed at will. Oh, doctors in the United States went delirious. They almost fainted. Something new, something brand new. It was only 3,500 years old. I learned about this when I was about 15. So when I read this of medicine, something or other, big new discovery and so forth, doctors all agog, I was fascinated. That was my first inkling of how far behind the United States was on just plain ordinary observation. Because any one of you could sit around and practice this for a while and you could find me do it, as long as your blood didn't give up on you. Of course, the way to do it is to learn how to voluntarily cut off the blood flow to your own hand. You say, all right, what's the muscular control of cutting off the blood flow to this hand? Now, we've been told that there are a lot of automatic responses in the body, that the involuntary, voluntary air warden systems or something, whereby little nerves run around and do involuntary actions. Oh, no, they don't. Did you ever become conscious of your own breathing and have to sit there, doggone it, and breathe for 2 or 3 minutes until you finally got it back into an involuntary proposition? Well, breathing is very easy to handle. It's intimately connected. I bet 2 or 3 of you now are going to sit there and have trouble breathing for a couple of minutes. Now, the system is not as automatic as you would think. You can make any part of your living come under your own analytical determinism, anything. If you were, for instance, to make a tremendous postulate of I'm going to start life anew, I'm going to be completely different after this moment, I am going to be brave, strong, beautiful, healthy, and so forth, you know, you actually could do it. The thing which you would dislike doing is throwing away your old memories. If you threw all those away, you see, because what you would do also, if you sat down solidly and made that postulate, then you go back over it in memory as to what that postulate was like, you would find yourself flick out of valence at that point. You just got through killing yourself. Simple as that. You say, well, I'm dead. As far as my past is concerned, it's all gone. And this is new, and this is the future. And from here on, it's going to be nothing but future, and none of this past stuff's going to worry me anymore. Well, what's that operation? That is the life-death cycle itself. And you can postulate it in this life if you want to. It's all right for you to postulate it. You always go back and remember postulating it and pick it up. Now, self-determinism reaches then very deeply. But what is it which makes it possible for one's self-determinism to handle himself so admirably? What is the monitor system used by self-determinism in order to handle the muscles? Now, that was another piece of the picture. Of course, the muscles are concerned in effort. The mind, the physical mind, is concerned with estimating efforts. You walk up to a door, you say, you just do an automatic computation. How much weight is it going to take to open this door? What's the amount of friction I need to establish between my hand and the door handle? Every once in a while, you're surprised. You walk up to a door and you confidently reach for the door handle and it stays there and you go down in tone immediately because you see you've been wrong. You estimate the effort that it will take to do something. Generally, that effort is right. But every once in a while, it's wrong. You have a sticking drawer in your home? Well, anybody who will tolerate a sticking drawer around is asking for it, because he'll go down in tone every time he estimates the effort to open this drawer, which is not very much. He should draw it open, pick up something up like that. He opens it. Bang! See, and then after a while, by the way, he'll go into apathy about it, and anything that's in that drawer, he will leave alone. He won't touch that drawer anymore. And he'll think, well, maybe it contains the telephone book. And he'll say, well, I guess I won't call him now. If he examines it, it's because he doesn't want to open this drawer. It always fights him. Now, he can whip that drawer very easily by saying, the estimation of effort to open this drawer is a jerky, twisty sort of an effort that takes a couple of minutes. Now, if he did that, it would never upset him because he's made a proper estimation of effort. What he insists on doing is going on his original estimation of effort. He keeps insisting that first one was right, and when the drawer sticks, each time he gets worse off. It's saying the contract is so-and-so, and it's never that way. All right, what this physical effort is very interesting. It's motion. It has to do with motion that is stored in the body and it's utilized in various ways by the body. As a matter of fact, that whole genetic blueprint, the whole blueprint of your physical construction depends upon efforts and counter-efforts in which you have been involved back down an enormously long genetic line. What are these efforts? Well, they're contained in memory. They're in facsimile. Call a facsimile, we just say a facsimile. Well, that's a handy way of saying a memory. Because you see, a memory, nobody has mentioned the word memory as though it was an item. Well, I remember that, the fellow says. Or my memory isn't so good. His ability to recall these pictures he has taken with all of his sense perception, sight, sound, hearing, and so forth, his ability to get these back may be poor, but believe me, they're all there. Everything which you experience, everything which you've seen, heard, felt, the temperature of your body at any moment in your lifetime, so all this is on recall. It's all on record. Well, we call these records, and boy, would they make a fancy-looking motion picture. They're color, three-dimensional, they're smellies, feelies, as well as talkies. They're tremendous. I mean, this is a great a big package, one of these facsimiles. Well, we call that a facsimile. When you get sick, you keep on recording. It becomes a little bit difficult to recall back into it, mostly because when you were very young, you agreed not to remember times when you were unconscious. They come in various things. You maybe agreed after just of yourself because you found out it was kind of painful. And it's usually on the basis, though, no, Willie, get in the dentist chair, that a nice dentist is a nice man. And why? I want to get in the dentist. Well, they want to pull your tooth, and you just sit down there, and you won't remember a thing about it, and you won't feel anything. I won't? No, no, we're going to put this nice mask over your face. And you just go to sleep, and you won't remember a thing about it. I will? All right, I will. Yeah, okay, that's fine with me. I agree at this moment that, what he's actually saying, that when I go unconscious, I will not remember anything that happens to me during that period of unconsciousness. A lot of malarkey. It's all on records. Matter of fact, it's in full analytical recall. As soon as you get that earliest postulate out, you people have been having such a hard time bucking into engrams and trying to knock the things floppy are fighting up against one of those original postulates. You find some of these cases just run through these engrams like nothing. Well, they say, yes, I always knew that. They just never agreed not to. All right, here are these moments of physical pain. Well, that's just another package. It's just another theta facsimile. Whether you're down the drugstore eating an ice cream soda or in a hospital getting your head sawed off, it's all the same kind of engram. It isn't anything special. I mean, the same kind of facsimile. One we call an engram because it's got physical pain in it, and the other we call a memory. Well, call them both facsimiles because they are basically the same thing. All right, afterwards, there's a pretty nurse, and maybe the fellow's feeling pretty good after his operation. He's lying there, and this pretty nurse walks in, and she says, "And how are you now?" Gee, I don't feel so good. I feel pretty bad. He didn't feel bad at all, see. I feel pretty bad. Well, now, we'll make you feel better. So he says, "Gee, this package that's just happening, boy, is that valuable. I'm in bad shape. See? I'm supposed to have, it says here, sympathy, bed, not go to work, not go to the office. I'm going to be sick for weeks," it says right here. I read in a book once whereby people were sick for weeks after this happened to them. I'm all set. isn't any reason why a guy can't walk out of a hospital. You know, it's interesting that the Tagalogs weren't ever told that you were supposed to stop when you were hit by a bullet, so they'd get hit with three or four bullets through the heart and one through the head and then run 75 yards, take a machete, and whop off an American soldier's head. This was disconcerting to our troops during the Philippine insurrection. So we sent a lot of people in and convinced them when you were hit by a bullet, you were supposed to die. And they have never repeated this performance. Interesting datum. They never have. Yet there were lots of Tagalogs running around getting shot at during World War II. None of them put on this kind of a performance. What actually happened to him was mechanical. Evidently, it doesn't take him a short time to die with a bullet in his heart. Evidently, he dies over quite a little period of time sometimes. It's how much fluid he loses. It's how much blood disappears out of the other organism. It's just like shooting a bullet into a machine. But the mental part of it is, says, I can die right now or I can wait a while. And the actual truth of it is that you can. Die and wait. Most people kill themselves off just on the basis of, well, it wasn't such a good life anyhow. Boom. Intention has a lot to do with dying as well. A fellow is all nerved up and he gets hit by something, he'll go into instantaneous rigor mortis. Bang. And it's interesting. He's postulated that he's supposed to be rigid, so forth, and bullet hits him, and he freezes right there. During the Civil War, they were making a big examination of this. There's some reports on records and some photographs by Brady showing snipers and things like that have been suddenly hit between the eyes in action, something like that. Still holding the rifle, still holding them alert, still propped up against a tree, finger on the trigger, not a thing disturbed about them at all. Stone dead. Well, he felt so punitive at the moment he was doing this that it was impossible for him to be hit, changed, or hurt. And all of a sudden he gets a nerve shock in reverse and it just freezes him just to that because it's so directly opposite to what he's doing. Number of explanations for it, but the point is that this individual is already holding on at a mad rate and he'll hold on to all the incoming impulse and he holds on to himself and he just freezes. Now another point of it is that somebody, after they've been dying for a half an hour or something like that, they'll eventually get tired of it and freeze and stop. They think maybe they're stopping pain or anything else, but they're really just stopping motion. Rigor mortis sets in. They get rigid. People wish all sorts of things off on themselves. I dare say there may be a person here tonight who remembers wishing something silly off on himself. I'd say offhand, there's probably some period that wasn't quite as sensible as it might have been, such as, I'm not going to go to school anymore because, or I'm not going to talk to him anymore because, or I'm going to leave him because, or some postulate on this order. Now, an auditor, going over this line so far, could take up effort on the one hand, which is to say the receipt of motion, giving forward motion. He could process this out of the facsimiles. You would find that there are motions with which people hold on to facsimiles. Somebody gets hit with a baseball in the forehead, and the moment he gets hit, he has a tendency to remain at a state of rest. He wants to remain here, whereas the baseball says he's supposed to remain here. He still has an impulse, you see, to hold his head solidly, and this actually has a tendency to put an effort in this engram, which holds the engram in. You see, he's resisting the baseball, and he could keep on resisting this baseball, and actually, one way or another, theoretically, he could go on resisting this baseball for the rest of his life, and would accept that he'll only hold on to that facsimile in event that he has made earlier postulates to hold on to such accidents. Now, the holding on to them, to invalidate people, to show the world it's wrong, to do this and to do that, we call this operation the self-determinism of a service facsimile, and we call these painful incidents or pitiful incidents or something of the sort that a person is holding on to and showing to people, we call those service facsimiles. Well, then a person can self-determine. He can say, well, I'll show them that I was right. Other things, I'll show them I was right. And here's, it's left a mark upon me. And you've done this to me, that sort of a thing. And starts holding these service facsimiles, and there'll get to be a whole chain of them. All the auditor has to do is blow out, actually, theoretically, just his self-determinism to hold onto these service facsimiles. These are psychosomatic illnesses. This is your habit of smoking. These are your eyeglasses, so on. Somewhere on the track, you made a postulate that you wanted to prove somebody wrong, or you were done an injustice, something of the sort, and you said, I'd show them. And you've used eyesight many times as an excuse for failure. Didn't read a road sign, went on by, and you say, my eyes aren't so good. Explains everything. Nobody can jump on you for that. Eyes aren't so good. The horrible part of it is your eyes are good. There's nothing wrong with your eyes at all. You can take glasses off people's noses with self-determined processing fairly rapidly. Pretty rapidly. But perhaps a little more important to us tonight, I've been giving you a review on this. Perhaps a little more important is the emotional curve and emotion and how to process emotion and what kinds of emotions there are. You see, I'm going to give you a little process that you can do yourself. If you can't improve your morale, your state of being, and your health about 200-300% in the next few days of this little gimmick I'm going to give you in the second part of the talk tonight, I'll be ashamed of you. All right.